one of the main things you'd be like embracing as a Jew is the very concept of halacha, which is usually translated as Jewish law. But the word halach comes from a very basic word, which is holech, means to walk. Those who do comparative religion say, even though the word functions like Jewish law, if I say, Rabbi, what's the halacha on this? I know you're asking, what's the legal ruling on this? What's the law on that? Am I allowed to drive an electric car on Shabbat? What's the halacha? What's the legal ruling on electricity on Shabbat? But if you go back to the spirit of where that word came from, comparative religion people say it's more like the word Tao that you get in like Chinese religion, which is because halacha literally means like the way you walk or the path you walk. It's like, it's this word like walking. So it either means, to go back to its root, your behavior. It's like the way you are, the way you move in the world. Or it could be your Tao, your path that you walk on in the world. And the word Tao in Chinese thought often functions the same way, as your Tao is the way you move in the world, or to follow the Tao means to follow like the right path. And I think halacha really means that, so that it functions like law, but its focus and its essence is on the, that there is this kind of energy that you bring to the world. And if you stop seeing the world in just the three dimensions of objects, and you're willing to open up to the, it, everything's, there's a divine energy everywhere, there's a higher power everywhere, then you realize that, if, as I often say, and you'll hear me say this, you'll get so sick of it after a while, when Rav Nadav's always saying, if you could put on your God glasses, because it, or the mystical glasses, whatever you want to say, you realize that like there is this very way you're behaving in the world that changes the world around you and that people are really relating to. So it's not just the words you say and the things you do. It's like the way you do them, and people are picking up on it all the time. And once you get into like a rhythm, like you're following the Tao and you are the Tao, or you're following the path and you're also walking the path, this is the idea of halacha. And so why that idea? The idea really is, and I'll probably say it a million times, is Judaism, if you put on your God glasses, the fundamental thing is how you are behaving in the world. So if I could put, when I say God glasses, I mean, if you can see the world as God sees the world, regardless of what your concept of God is. But let's just say, if I can put on my glasses, see the world, in Judaism, I would say that if I'm looking at you right now, I don't see what you believe. The God glasses don't see into your head. It's not like, oh, and I'll try to quote, I'll badly try to use some Christian stereotype. It's not that I can see you are saved. I can see that, you know, you have been redeemed by the belief in the Son of God who died for your sins, and therefore you have achieved, you know, you have self. Like, we don't see into your ideas, your mind, your concepts, your language. I might see that you walk with a confidence and a grace, and that can be true of any religion, by the way. I mean, so I'm trying to be positive about Christianity, which is, it wouldn't be that I see that you have the right beliefs and you know that Jesus is Son of God and that you went to baptism at some point and you're all good, and you went to confession. It would be like, I'm just seeing, like, you have an ease with which you are kind. You have an ease with which a confidence, and you don't have the same tension that the other people are having. And that's what I would see. I wouldn't know its source. The source wouldn't matter. In that sense, if you have that, and I also see the Dalai Lama walk in, and the Dalai Lama has that, it's not because, I wouldn't see the difference. I'm not seeing the beliefs. I'm just seeing the results of them, the halacha, the behavior, the way you are in the world. And then all the things that you do, your actions, which is, wow, you know, you have this grace and confidence, but I noticed that you walked right past a beggar and you were like, they smell. So I was like, that's weird. So the God glasses don't see beliefs. The God glasses only see your behavior. Take that to another step with halacha. There is something true about the way you behave in the world. Like I said, whether you're kind or you're not, these are not just culturally relative norms. That in the God glasses, like, there really is, There are maybe not right and wrong, but there are better and worse ways of behaving. And that enough is enough to make you not a cultural relativist. In other words, that it's not about the fact that, well, I just am influenced by the fact that I grew up Jewish, that you shouldn't walk by a beggar. It's that I really think it's in the fabric of the universe that if you don't have compassion for people who are in a bad situation, that that's fundamentally wrong. It would be as wrong as saying, when I drop something, it falls because of gravity. That's the way it ought to, that's the way it is. And for someone to say that people who are sick and poor on the streets, they had it coming. They're just lazy. After all, this is America. If only they got off their ass and did some work, they would, that is wrong. That's like saying, if only that rock flew upward, why doesn't it just fly upward? It's just insensitive. So I want to say that moral law is part of the fabric of the universe as much as natural physical laws. And so halakha is about finding a way to be in this world that accords with those, with a beautiful way of being that lets you be more caring and more open. And some of it comes down to specifics. So now I'm going to get to the last part, which is really, maybe not the very last part, but what you brought up, which is kind of prophecy and the role of people and the role of being, how does this get legalistic? And so initially in the Bible, let me go back to the very beginning for a second. The Bible says humanity came into being. I believe the Bible is completely compatible with evolution, and we talked about that. I'm happy to talk about that sometime because it's a beautiful idea. But if you read Genesis, as I think the correct way to read it is it's talking about a period between 15,000 and roughly 4,000 BCE. Relatively quickly, it talks about the origins of agriculture and human civilizations. And it says that when we transition from being hunter-gatherers, who were relatively peaceful, and we started to have settlements, it's almost like the Old West, and if you watch Westerns, you start to have these towns, and then those towns started to have prostitutes, and they started to have gambling, and they started to have bad guys, and they started to have violence and theft. A lot of that is kind of backed up by actual history. The Bible is saying, whoa, what happened when we started gathering in Babylonia? And we started gathering in the Tigris-Euphrates River, and we started gathering by the Nile in Egypt. And we went from these very unpopulated hunter-gatherers to these settlements. They were awful places to be. There were places where the poor and women and children and people were just raped and taken advantage of. And that was against what we could be and should be. And so it says that God chose this tribe of shepherds, and they were just hanging out in nature. They had their animals. They took care of animals. They didn't own land. They were nomadic. They lived in tents. They didn't have a lot of material objects. Their culture itself was not very stratified. It wasn't about who owned land and who were the nobility, and they controlled the police and had private armies. It was none of that. These were just a bunch of people living in tents in the middle of the Mideast in what's now Israel with some goats. And they used to play flutes and lyres and instruments. And God said, we're going to start with those people. Those people, we're going to build on what they're doing in their little mini nomadic civilization. And eventually that people is going to have its own country, which is weird. There are people who don't have land. They're going to have land. And this one guy, more than anybody, people used to speak with God. The idea, particularly Abraham, Isaac, not so much, Jacob, they do have visions of that there's a destiny for this shepherd people. They actually don't know necessarily they're going to eventually have their own country because they're just kind of quasi-homeless nomads. But then you get this guy Moses. And Moses has this enlightenment. And the enlightenment is we shepherds who have now been enslaved and brutalized in Egypt, which is, I think, historically true, we're going to get out and we're going to make a country where this never happens to anybody. And justice is basically a just and fair society is our main thing and involves a lot of laws. So it starts being that the prophet he's a prophet. He's like, I'm, and it, anyway, he said, I'm channeling God's intentions. and we're going to have a society. There's going to be no king, because kings just become tyrants. Tyranny, and so fine, it's like the founding fathers, American Revolution. Tyranny is just the opposite of what's acceptable. But it's like, but we're going to have a rule of law. And so all these laws start coming out. It's not necessarily the way we think of prophecy, but prophecy was like, and if you actually read the laws, they are things like, they're things like, you're going to have judges who are not paid by the nobles, so that even a poor person and a rich person are equally judged under the law. And neither the rich person nor the poor person is going to be judged better or worse based on where they're from. It says things like, if someone is, if you loan a poor person money and their only collateral is their sewing machine or their landscape equipment or, you know, their cow, that you can never actually repossess that. You can't repossess the item that they use to make money, even if they pawned it to you for a loan. Because that's actually, in the ancient world, that's actually how you became a slave. So you didn't, it wasn't like black slavery in America where people bought and sold slaves. That's not the way it was so much certainly in the Bible period. It was almost all through debt, a lot like student loans today. It really was that you took out a loan, you couldn't pay it back. And there by ancient law, you now basically had to pay off that debt through a long-term indentured to someone. So he's like, you can't have that. So you can't have, that's going to happen if people take out loans, and then they're like, so I'm going to take, you know, yeah, you do Uber, I'm going to take your car. I mean, then the person's going to become a slave because they're not going to be able to do their job. So these laws about animals and kindness to animals, you can't overburden animals. If you see an animal struggling, you have to help it, even if it belongs to your worst enemy. If you use an animal to run a millstone to create flour, it was common practice to muzzle the animal because they would stop pushing the millstone to create flour to eat the wheat on the floor. And they said, can't do that. Anytime your animal who's pushing the millstone, your ox, wants to eat from the floor, they can do it. And so it's all these laws, and they're clearly about building society which has compassion, fairness, rule of law, lots of stuff about rape and about, you know, assault, like that it's not acceptable, and rights of women, things like that. And just lays out this legislation, and then as you well know, the Bible continues with the story of us entering the promised land, trying to create that culture, and having good and bad kings, so on and so forth. Going back to halakha. So prophecy and law was closely related. And then you have more prophets. Basically, our country was eventually destroyed. And then you have the whole book of prophets. And the book of prophets, more than anything says, as we've talked, that more than anything it says, how could God's own personal country be destroyed? If our understanding of the history of the world is God had some plan for the human species, that we could be capable of amazing things, and started this project with the shepherd people, that somehow you're gonna figure this out with my help and bring it to folks. And now your country's destroyed. Like, what's the future? What happened? And the prophets mostly say, in very complex poetic language, that we must not have had the compassionate society God planned. Like, maybe we did our sacrifices in the temple, and maybe we collect our tithes, and maybe we did these other things. But there must have been something that we like just hugely failed at. And mostly they say we didn't take care of the poor and the widow and the orphan. Like, mostly what they said is we built a society a lot like America, which is we could all celebrate and be very patriotic and be like, yay, Jewish country, land of Israel. But the truth is that when God, if we could, the prophets wore God glasses. When you put on your God glasses, you're like, you know what? You can talk all day long about how exceptional and amazing it was called Judea or Judah. You know, the country of Judah is all amazing, but the truth is, if you scratch the surface, you see a lot of the things that the Torah was about doing, they're still going on. So that's why God allowed it to be destroyed. And so the prophets are really about social justice. They're really into social justice, which I think is amazing. Okay, so then the Bible kind of ends historically around 200 or 300 BCE. And we're left with a set of laws and principles by which to live. The rabbis take those laws and say, well, if the country is not going to exist, is it possible to have Judaism without a country? Because we get our country back from the Assyrians and Babylonians, but then it's destroyed by the Romans. And so the rabbis say, there's a way to be Jewish in this world and walk in this halacha way to, without having a country. And that's a radical idea, because it seemed like the whole project of the Bible was that we'd have a country in which we showed everyone how you do it. And, you know, and look, people like me, we still give sermons once in a blue moon, and we say, you know, we say we can't have, people say an advanced country can't have national health care as a right. Look at Israel. Israel's had national health care since it began in 1948. My wife and I got fertility treatments in Israel for free. We were practically tourists. I mean, it was amazing. You know what I mean? It was like, you mean I'm sick and I can show up at a hospital and I'm a tourist? And they're like, yeah, like we don't deny health care to people and you're not going to get a bill. I was like, I thought I learned in my country that wasn't possible. You know, so we all thought it was supposed to be about we were going to have a country and everyone else was going to be like, can we be like them? They're amazing. They work to these laws and a system. And the rabbi said, well, when Romans destroyed it, they said, maybe we need to sort of have this portable sphere around us. That is your own personal Jewish way of being in the world. And somehow that'll accomplish it. And they had this idea, which maybe is false. I mean, I don't know, that that people would look at us. You know, and in different, it doesn't have to be Orthodox or something. You know, people would look at you and look at me and look at you and they'd be like, I want to be like her, like just at work. They'd be like, what's going on with Juliet? Like, I mean, that and we do this. I mean, one of my daughter's best friends at school is Mormon. And sometimes we're like, she's so cool. You know, and like her family seems so at peace and they seem so together. And you're like, what's going on with that? You know, and so like, the rabbis thought we'd be like that. People would be like, that's so cool the way they do it. Not because we have these beliefs. They wouldn't be like, oh, did you hear about that Mount Sinai thing? I got to get in on the Mount Sinai. It has nothing to do with beliefs. It was like, just the way they do it. That's halacha. Now, and they said, well, how do you do it? How do you walk in the world that way? And they realized that you have to update the laws. Because new circumstances come up all the time. Having a country, not having a country, that's a pretty big change. Living in Egypt, and I don't mean in the Bible period. I mean after, I'm talking about if you're living in 400 CE, after the Bible's already over, you could be an Egyptian Jew, you could be a Turkish Jew, you could be an Italian Jew, you could be a French Jew. There's going to be challenges of different places, whether you live in Venice, or you live in Cairo, or you live in Istanbul. And so they're like, well, how are you going to walk that walk? How are you going to be that person? And they said it requires wisdom. And the wisdom comes from these legal discussions and investigations and working things out. So I'll try to like give an example, which is you need 10 adult Jews to pray, to pray certain prayers. We have new things that come up today, which is can I FaceTime someone in? If you're on FaceTime or Skype, can I count you as the 10th person? Because we often have to count because we don't get there. So if someone needs to do the memorial prayer because their mother died, you need 10 people, and sometimes we're at 9. Can I Skype someone in? That problem has never existed before. So who has the wisdom to know? And they realize you take the wisest people. They call themselves the rabbis. The rabbis are the teachers. They know the law. They've studied the law like I have for years and years and years. And you ask the rabbi. And then they said, wait a second, there should be groups of rabbis. So one rabbi doesn't think that they're like the cult leader who has all the answers. And that's basically what evolved is we had groups of rabbis who would argue issues and take votes. And the majority would rule. Or, as you said, if you just had a little local issue, just you, like let's say you said, Rabbi, I'm trying to work out whether I can do this or that on Shabbat, then you would go to your local rabbi. So there were the rabbis in the ancient period were not like rabbis are today. They were much more like local civil judges. They were like Judge Judy or Judge Wapner, whoever the latest judge is on TV. They adjudicated local disputes and they were knowledgeable about the law. And so you might just go to your local rabbi and say, the classic example is this, which is you can't eat a chicken if it's diseased, right? So people would bring their chickens to the rabbi and be like, this chicken's looking a little sickly. Am I allowed to eat it or not? And so there are a lot of stories like that because they're true. So, you know, you don't have to get 10 rabbis together to take a vote about that. You know what I mean? You just go to your local rabbi and I'm like, looks fine. It's kosher. You can eat it. Or But if you had, but if there were really big questions, like can we use Skype to count people in a prayer quorum, then that's going to have to go to the level where we have a big public debate among rabbis and we take votes. And we still do it today, by the way, on these big questions. We really, really do. And now I finally get to your the essence of your question, which is, how do we, how do we know that if, I don't know, seven rabbis, nine rabbis, 10 rabbis, doesn't matter, they argue like the Supreme Court today. We argue around a table for days, hours about a particular question, and then we take a vote. How do we know we got it right? That's not the same thing as Moses saying, I just communed with God, and I've got another law to throw at you guys. This one's about animals. Or, and because Moses is always adding things. And Moses is like, I just communed with God again. I got a new one for you. That's very different than like, let's take a vote. And there's always people who disagree in the votes, like rarely unanimous. So it's like, how do we know that the three guys who voted against it aren't the ones in the right? And it feels like a very legalistic religion, halakha, that we determine this way of walking in the world through this like legal process and votes. And so then they have this idea. And I just did it earlier today in my Torah study class. The Talmud's really long. It feels like more. I don't have one up here. I have one at home. It fills up like three shelves in tiny print. But one of the stories in there that is like maybe the most famous story in the Talmud, I'm going to tell you. Okay, so you ready for a story? One day, the rabbis had a case where a new invention of an oven, it was a new kind of oven, was introduced, and they wanted to know if that oven was kosher, if it could be used in a right way for kosher food. And it was a very technical decision about whether this kind of oven could be used to cook kosher food. And they had a big debate, and they argued it back and forth to the point where the entire group of rabbis said it is kosher, and one rabbi, there's only one left in the minority, and he said that it was not kosher. And the rabbi in the minority said, I don't care what y'all say, but I'm right. And they're like, well, it's too bad because we already took our vote and you clearly are wrong. And so he says, well, I can show you that I'm right. I can call upon God. And they said, what? Because you know, we're talking about prophecy now in a way. I can call upon God. He said, what do you mean? So he said, first, if I'm right, God, and he looks up at the sky, make this tree bend over. And the tree bends over. And so the other rabbis say, according to the story, they say, we don't make legal decisions based on trees. So he says, okay. The river, the brook that goes by the house we're in, let it go back. God, if I'm right, let it go backward. And it goes backward. And they say, water doesn't get a vote. And then he says, okay, fine. I'll call upon God. If I'm right and everyone else is wrong about this decision, tell us. And literally the voice of God, it says the voice of God, Abakol, comes out of the sky and says, the law should be with Rebbe, and he names the guy who's in the minority. And it's kind of like precisely your question, which is, how do we know, how do we know that when we make these decisions, it's what God wants? And the rest of the rabbis look up at the sky and they say, God, you say in the book of Deuteronomy that the Torah is no longer in heaven. It is on the earth. And it is not so difficult that people on the earth can't figure it out. And it's a very famous line in Deuteronomy. Well, you probably know, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, which is, it says that because people say to Moses, Moses, how are we going to go into the promised land without you? Because you're the one who knows how to do everything. And Moses says, you'll be fine. I'm going to die. You'll be fine. You have the Torah. The Torah is not in heaven that you should say it is too complicated and hard a thing for a person to understand. The Torah is understandable and you can figure it out yourselves. So they quote that part and they're like, so the Torah is not in heaven anymore. So stay out of it, God. It's for us to figure out how to apply it and how to make it work. And God says at the end of the story, God says, you're right. That is what I said. So the story is there to tell us that we may be wrong about some of the things that we say, the Torah says. In fact, we're almost certainly going to be. But it doesn't matter anymore because we're not open to people saying, I'm the only one with the true Judaism, I speak to God. even if they could speak to God, God's voice doesn't count anymore. Like it's another way of saying there's a book on Jews in history that says that we may have been like children in the books of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Maybe when we as a slave people came out of Egypt, we were like kids, or we were like, how are we going to live in this complicated world with these new rules? But the bottom line is that the covenant needs to switch the other way, which is we have to take the leadership role, which is we have to figure, we can't be kid. You know, our faith is not like a kid faith. You know, God will take care of us. And you even see it in the way we practice. I mean, sometimes when I've prayed with non-Jews, it doesn't feel right on me, because I feel like I'm not praying to the Heavenly Father. Like, it's not Heavenly Father, you are my parent. I don't even know what that means. I don't even know what it means to say, God, you're my parent. Take care of me. Take care of everything. I do pray to a higher power, but it's not that kind of like, I'm a kid and you're my dad or you're my mom. Like that, it just doesn't feel right to me. And that's partly because in Judaism, the idea is like, we grew up and we got everything we needed. Like, I guess God's like the parent who gave us everything God could give us with revelation or Torah or wisdom or what our ancestors figured out. And now we're supposed to figure out how to apply it and how to deal with it. So it's very legalistic in the way that we have to apply it and we have to figure out how to make it real so we can walk in this world in that genuine way. We're not like ISIS. We're not like, well, let's build something straight out of the 9th century. I can't walk in the 9th century anymore. We're in the 21st century. So I got to feel like some way I can walk it in this world, in my life, in this setting that's never existed before. It's never been like this before. And it's not just because of Facebook or Snapchat. It's like, you could go back a generation. My parents could say the same thing. It was never like this before, because now we have this. And then generation before, it's like, well, it's never been like this before. I mean, now we have women's rights. And before that, we never like this before, you know, so that it's always been never like this before. So it can't be like we're going to live the way Moses lived. So we have to apply it. And we have this method in Judaism, which is wisdom will come out of open, sincere, knowledgeable debate. And the best you can do is see it from every possible angle and really listen to others who are like the Supreme Court does today, listen to others who are presenting different view, and then really being open using that process. The last thing I will say about that is, though, that, okay, if you say, well, Rav and Dov, you made it sound really good. You made it sound like you convinced me. We can do without prophecy. We just got to work it out ourselves. But how about this part where, like, what if we are wrong? Like, what if we're way off? I mean, certainly I feel like if Jesus came back right now, he probably wouldn't be too comfortable going into a lot of the evangelical churches. You know, so how do we know we're not totally off? And if Moses could come back, or there was a real prophet walking among us, that they wouldn't be like, God, you guys are doing it all wrong. This sucks. Like, if you think this is halacha, your energy, and I've got the God glasses, and I can tell you, like, you're way off. How do you know that's not happening? And the answer is, we believe in pluralism, which is that there are going to be different communities that make different decisions, whether it's Orthodox, conservative, and Reform, or regional, the way the Jews do it in Spain versus the way the Jews do it in Poland or Israel. Like, there are going to be regional variations where they're trying to apply to their communities. And some I look at and I'm like, I think that's way off. When I look at how that community is doing it in Israel, I just feel like they call that walking with God. Like, I just, you know, it's creepy to me. So the answer is we're not all doing it the same way. So that there's going to be regional variation. It's not so unlike in America. I mean, we have this great idea that, I don't know, maybe it's not a great idea. It's amazing to me that in America we can have something like the right to bear arms. And in Massachusetts, that means that you can barely buy a firearm. And in Texas, it means you can walk into any store and buy an assault rifle and walk into a schoolyard. I mean, like, I don't understand how that's possible, but it's called pluralism, meaning we have the same constitution, and they've interpreted the halakha this way, and Massachusetts interpreted the halakha that way. And maybe in time we'll see which one. That's the price of not having prophecy. The price of not having prophecy is not that we're all going to go off in one direction and be wrong. What we have is a lot of different directions, and I'm willing to live with that. I'm kind of scientific. I'm kind of like, you know, let all the laboratories operate and let's see which one in the long run works out. But I also don't, if someone says to me, well, there's this community over there doing it like this way, I don't mind saying, yeah, from my point of view, they're way off. From my point of view, I think Moses would be sickened by what they're doing, you know? I'm open to that. But so I don't know if that's the end of my whole long spiel, which is, I don't know if that really answers your question, but I would say this, that there's a weirdness in it, which is we are a legalistic religion. And even in some Christian critiques of us, that you're so legalistic. The Pharisees were legalistic in the Old Testament, blah, blah, New Testament, those Pharisees. We kind of are, but it's part of this kind of philosophical wisdom tradition, which is we actually do believe in science and the facts, and we believe in the intellect. We are not a religion that thinks you should be just turning off your intellect. We are a religion that thinks that we want you to be emotional too, but we want to link the two. Like it's very rare. I don't want to say never, 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 but almost never in Judaism will we tell you that in order to believe something or in order to do something, you should turn off your brain. We have sometimes been too intellectual and not emotional enough, but the goal is clearly to link the two. Like it's not like, oh, you ask too many questions. Just turn off your brain. You know, it's like, no, I mean, you know, at a funeral, you should just say the person who died was such a righteous person. Actually, in Judaism, if they weren't such a righteous person, you shouldn't say that. Oh, come on. You know, it's like, no, there's no come on. Like, you're never asked to be like, but my brain is telling me this is uncomfortable. Your brain, in Judaism, you're never like, just shut off your brain right now. No, if you're uncomfortable, it's like, should we really be doing a funeral and saying nice things that aren't true about a person? And the rule is, no, you shouldn't. Please don't lie at funerals. There's no good will come of it.